Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Kip Scheline of Levinson Venture Partners. Tonight we take a closer look at the business of keeping your company in business. The topic is exit strategies, making a decision to sell. IPO, sell, stay the course, raise money, there are a lot of different options. And what I'm going to try and do with this group of panelists is address a range of different alternatives, but really focus on that point where you've decided that you really do need to find a buyer and merge upstream. There are a lot of different options and probably more than we could discuss this evening, but I think it's a very interesting topic. The panel of experts we have tonight is very impressive. Fentress Seagroves is a partner in PricewaterhouseCoopers private company services practice. He leads the M&A services practice there, focuses on transaction services, due diligence, valuation, and corporate finance strategies. Jeff Fleur is the former co-founder and CEO of StubHub and was responsible for setting the company's overall direction in 2006. Fleur was honored with a spot on the street and Smith's Sports Business Journal's prestigious 40 Under 40 list. Grant Evans, former CEO of A4 Visions, is a seasoned senior executive with over 23 years of operating experience, four startups, by the way. Currently, he serves on the board of directors for 3VR, Bioscript, and was recently nominated to Active Identity, a NASDAQ-listed company. And Bill Wisielowski, a partner at Seven Hills Partners, has been an investment banker specializing in mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures for 20 years, having worked at Morgan Stanley, Robertson Stevens, and now Seven Hills. Please welcome our panel. So I think the starting point here is if you have a company and you're trying to decide what to do with it, first of all, the U is a management team, it could be a board of directors, it could be an individual who has got a controlling position. But in any case, you have to take stock of the situation and try and understand what the conditions are that might lead to a successful sale. Different companies are in different markets. They're growing at different rates. They are, in some cases, very profitable, in other cases, just squeaking along. All of those conditions can make a difference in terms of the success, the number of potential buyers, the time it takes to sell your company, et cetera. What I'd like to do is start by focusing questions on our two entrepreneurs and just asking them, big picture, what were the factors in your decision process to sell the company? And I'd like to start with Jeff here and StubHub just to talk about the things that he was thinking about at the highest level as he was trying to make the decision about selling the company.
Sure. There were a number of factors that went into our decision. Ultimately, StubHub was acquired by eBay about a year ago. And we had had conversations with prospective buyers over the course of the entire sort of 7 years that I ran the company. We were never out actively looking to sell the company, but there had been a couple of occasions where potential interested parties came to us to talk about acquiring the company. Those conversations never got serious until the last set of conversations with eBay, which ultimately did result in our acquisition. You know, the things that we really considered were there were a number of investors who had been involved with the company for a number of years, anywhere from 2 years at the low end up to 7 years at the high end. So folks that were involved for 6 or 7 years were looking for a return on their investment and were getting eager to find a liquidity event. Other factors that went into that decision was my own and the rest of the management team's kind of personal life goals and desire to stay involved in what we were doing. So I had run the company for 7 years. I had gotten married and had a kid in that 7 years and felt that, you know, there were other things I wanted to do in my life. And so that was a factor as well. And I think, you know, when you the other factors that we looked at were sort of external to the company, things like the competitive landscape, the market environment, and the environment in the financial markets as well. So we took all those things into consideration and looked at what we thought were the right the right outcome for the company. And given the interest level that eBay showed when we had those conversations, it turned out that that made the most sense for us at that time.
And just one last thought on that. Did you consider an IPO? And if you did at the time, what were the merits or demerits of that consideration?
Yeah, sure. We did. We did consider an IPO. Those types of considerations became magnified when eBay expressed the level of interest that they did, because that was it really brought everything to a head. We needed to make a decision if we were going to, so to speak, do the dance with eBay or if we were going to pursue other alternatives. And so we definitely considered going public at that time, and the business was at a point from a revenue scale perspective and a profitability perspective that we felt, given the market conditions at the time, we had that option. We could go public. The valuation that eBay offered relative to the valuation we may have gotten in the public markets was compelling, particularly in light of the fact that in doing a deal with eBay, we would be able to bring all of our investors and our equity holders immediate liquidity. That is to say that they would get cash right away for their shares in the company, as opposed to when you go public, it's really in many ways the beginning, not the end. It isn't necessarily a liquidity event for people who own shares, because you don't actually sell those shares when you go public. You sell new shares. The company sells new shares. So for a lot of reasons, we felt that from a valuation perspective and a liquidity perspective, and that the deal with eBay made a lot of sense, and in relation to an IPO.
Okay, that's great. Grant, let me address the same question. Again, different company, different circumstances. What were the factors as you and your board decided to look for a buyer for your company that contributed to that decision and how they got resolved?
Yeah, so I'll give you actually two perspectives or two specific examples, one of a company that I did about 12 years ago and one most recent, A4 Vision, and quite different in their approach. A4 Vision was an early stage company, great technology. We were moving, but one of the factors that was influencing us, it was heavily capitalized with venture capital money. We had a market that was consolidating very aggressively. In particular, there was two or three companies, a couple in Europe and one here in the U.S., that were basically on a buying spree using a public balance sheet. And one in particular who we ended up, ultimately where this company ended up with, has made some 18 acquisitions in a period of about 28 months. And the alternative to not doing something was we were running into heavy competition. We couldn't compete against them. We were a piece of the puzzle versus an entire solution. And if we didn't make a move and do something, I would say, to sort of clone a phrase, you don't get to cross that chasm into the next stage of life for an early stage company. And so we elected as a board. I did have some convincing to do with the board. There were some that were saying it makes a lot of sense. There was others. Some of the early stage investors were concerned. So I had a lot of work cut out in terms of keeping everybody on parity in terms of the vision and what the alternatives were, and that took a lot of education, a lot of time spent in one-on-one conversations, as well as just in general as a board. And eventually we got there, but it did take a lot of work. And we ended up concluding that deal, but it was more of a forced situation from the perspective that the market was consolidating very aggressively. And when we first started this company, there was about 12 companies around the world that had this particular type of technology, machine vision. And at that time period, it was down to 3. So it was moving pretty rapidly. And so we were more of a forced situation. And ultimately, it's playing out fine. But anyway, the factors there were the surrounding market. On the other scenario, totally different. We're a small startup company again, bootstrapped with some $1 million from just angel investors. And we reached a point in the business where we were on a high growth rate. We had two options. One, we had a number of people come around try to talk to us about acquisition. We were holding out, but the alternative was we also needed to take in capital for growth. And we had conversations with the venture capital community, And we ultimately elected to merge the company with a public company. And we had two or three options in that place at that time. It was an incredible valuation. It was about 14 times on our revenue base at that stage. And when we did that merger, we also got the chance to be very influential on this public platform company. All of the founders went across. There was four of us involved, two engineers, two business guys. And fortunately, we were in the era of the 2000 vintage, so we got to ride the wave of the valuations there. And we took this company from some $240 million market cap to something along the lines of $1.3 billion in about 18 months. So our investors walked out with a handsome reward on it, but two different, very, very different scenarios in terms of how we made those decisions.
Okay, that's great. That's the entrepreneur's perspective, and what I wanted to do now was try and get a perspective from the bankers and advisors. And I'm going to start, it's a little bit unfair to Fentress, I'm going to start with Bill and ask him to characterize his ideal client. In other words, when you meet a client for the first time and everything is just working perfectly, what's the profile of that client? And I know he has a few different ideas.
Well, Kip gave me a heads up on this one, but I changed my mind. I want Grant's buy-side client who did 18 trades in 28 months.
Right.
But my initial reaction to Kip was that we'd like to have serial clients so we can help them raise money and deploy capital. But on the sell side, either it's a company that is perfectly packaged up, ready to go. And again, if I want to turn it into a serial client, and what might be best for the client is help them recapitalize the company, take money off the table, bring in a growth capital partner, and allow them to grow it together. The easy answer would be to have three or four proposals lined up, and I get to drop in and in 30 days get a deal done. But it's a company that is hitting on all cylinders, ready to sell, realizes it needs to go to the next level, and is looking for the next stewardship to manage the growth of the company. It's difficult oftentimes with entrepreneurs. They wring their hands. We've had many people to the altar only to decide that they're not ready to sell, they're not ready to take money. On the other hand, corporates also can be very, very hands-on as well. So, you know, every deal is different, but you want a company that's not broken. You want a company that has more than enough cash to get through the process and then some, and you want to have a company that's actually going to be attractive to multiple players to create competition.
So the flip side of that question, I was going to direct to Fentress, which is if you could model the least ideal client. In other words, a client comes to you, they want to be they want you to help them get ready to package the company, prepare the company for sale, and there's a litany of issues and problems. What's the profile of that client? What kinds of things are typically problems or problematic when you're in an advisory situation and you're dealing with a company that has a variety of issues like that?
Well, I think the first thing that concerns me is when there's a weak management team. One of our rules is you always bet on the A-plus management team and the B-minus business rather than the reverse of that, because management teams are really absolutely critical for valuation, driving valuation. Clearly, there's a whole litany of business issues around the business that are important in terms of attracting buyers and attracting capital. Position, competitive positions, what's going on in the marketplace. You talked about consolidation. You know, how well positioned are you for the longer term? And I think Bill makes a good point of that. I want somebody who's not at the end of the rope, not panicking, not having to make decisions on emotions, but rather has got to be able to play that trump card of walking away or having an alternative that means run the business. From a process management perspective, I want a client that's committed to a process. I don't want a client that starts and stops, that's confused around objectives, that hasn't really sorted through the difference that Jeff talked about those objectives that might be personal, that might be objectives of the board, that might be objectives of the shareholders. I want those things worked through because those can create problems down the way. I also want a client that has its financial house in order. I want good financials. I want reliable information. I don't want surprises. I want the client to really understand how their business drivers work, what drives the value of that business, and have some realistic expectations both around why the buyers are interested, what their valuation expectations are, and how they get ready for going out to the market, whether they're dealing with one or two buyers at the table or they got somebody like Bill taking them out to a broader auction.
So and Bill talked about the private equity buyers and the possibility of doing a roll-up, recapitalizing the company and basically rolling the dice again going forward, trying to grow from there. In your mind, Fentress, is the scrutiny that each of these different kinds of buyers goes through similar, or are there hot buttons that are more important to strategic buyers than to financial buyers? And how does that map to the IPO market and what it takes to get ready there?
Well, let's see. I need about four hours to answer this one.
Yeah.
And I'll let my esteemed colleagues up here chime in as well. But just at a simplistic viewpoint, strategic buyers are going to be focused not just on the core business and the cash flows that the business can bring to the table, whether it's day one or in year five. They're also going to be looking for synergistic opportunities. Is there a technology play? Is there a leverage opportunity with sales forces? Is there a back office consolidation? Whereas private equity money, for a lot of my clients, they're looking at how do they finance it, how do they structure it, how is the bank going to perceive it, because debt levels are so important in terms of driving their returns, and they're much more focused on the core cash flows because they don't have the synergies to bring to the table. A lot more financial scrutiny I see in the private equity space, and then a lot more focus around management as well, because they're oftentimes relying on that management team and the growth that they expect, whereas a strategic buyer might be able to come in and say, hey, this is a great business, it's great that you have good managers, we'll incorporate them, but we also have good managers that can take that technology as well.
I just add one thing to that, just to accentuate that point. In our transaction where we sold StubHub to eBay, I'd like to think the management team was pretty good, but I don't know about that. But actually, eBay didn't need our management team, and eBay didn't want me to stay, as an example. So they were able to not even integrate our management team into eBay. They just had their own guy come in and run the company. So you see that a lot in strategic transactions, I think, where sometimes the management team's a key asset, and sometimes they have their own people they want to run the company. So whereas in a financial buyer, to Fentress's point, typically, although not always, you're going to see situations where the financial buyer is going to back the management team and needs that management team to run the company.
Yeah, the typical comment from a top VC or a top private equity guy is, can I back this management team? The business, I agree with, A-plus management team, B-minus business is easier to defend. So unless it's a bolt-on to an existing platform that they've got, management team is critical. And it doesn't matter how good the business is, they don't want to buy a company to dump the management team and replace it. They don't run businesses.
So going back just for a second to the IPO market, I think that I don't remember who it was who mentioned that the IPO is not necessarily an exit. I wanted to ask Bill just to comment in a little bit more detail on why it's not an exit, because the IPO used to be the holy grail, and it's a lot more complicated and difficult right now for a whole host of reasons, excuse me, to get a company public than it was 7, 8, 9 years ago. But even back then, there were a lot of challenges around this nirvana of the IPO, which was going to make everybody wealthy, and people discovered after the fact that it wasn't necessarily the case. So you want to comment on that just a little bit, Bill?
Yeah, first the hard, cold facts. Record year this year, 75 IPOs by venture capital-backed companies. That's 75. There are about 10,000 M&A trades. So it's tough to get public in any event. I think in terms of the reality on IPO and going public, and the specific question is does that change? There's a venture capitalist out there in town who says, and they invest before and after the IPO, and their mantra is, it's just another day in the financing life of a company. Typically, management can sell up to 15% of their holdings in the other investors, so it's not panacea where you get all your cash out and can leave. So you're really tied to the company. With Sarbanes-Oxley, which is the regulatory requirements of being a public company getting increasingly onerous, it's very expensive to be public. It's very time-consuming to be public. You still have got to perform. You have to do it under a microscope. So it's a great way for some companies to find access in the future for additional pools of capital at different return requirements, but it's not something that you can do and walk away from the business. So I think it's good for some companies, but most companies will be sold or merged as opposed to going public.
Fair enough. So assuming you have made the decision to try and find a buyer for your company, or perhaps you're fortunate enough to already have several buyers at the table, I was going to direct this question to Grant. How did you go about creating a list of buyers that were on your candidate list, the best buyers of your candidate list?
The first thing that we did, we basically knew the ecosystem of the sector we're in pretty well, and we went through a process simply of matching up where we're going to have the greatest value from a strategic standpoint with those customers. And it's not none of the my examples were about really positive cash flow or anything to accretive in that sense. It was more how well our product set and our technology would be accretive to the company. And we ended up with a short list of half a dozen companies. And when we started the process or started thinking about it, we made sure that we were extremely well positioned to be compatible with those companies. In fact, we went way out of our way to do it, both from simple things like public relations to make sure that we were on their radar, to making sure that we weren't in conflict with their technology or product compared to ours. And as we started that process, eventually you start forming relationships with these companies and building it, and you may have a concerted effort to try and figure out some sort of partnership with them, whether it's a simple sort of just general partnership reference, or it's an OEM license or some sort of cross-license deal with them. But usually they're the best suitors for it in terms of an ultimate exit strategy for you. But I think you've got to think through it pretty carefully, and you've got to understand that ecosystem and also understand where the industry's going and who are the consolidators and who's going to get consolidated.
So, and I guess my question for Jeff would be, we heard a little bit about that his perspective on this issue, but my assumption was that part of the reason you sold was to help scale the business, and you've suggested at least that eBay already had this in mind that they wanted to do this, they wanted to do it with your business, they didn't really need the team there to drive it. What were the conditions, regulatory, market, otherwise, that enabled this huge growth in internet, I guess I call it internet-enabled resale of tickets, and what was the, what were the conditions that sort of brought you into this process, identifying buyers, whether it was eBay or somebody else? Were there other options, and how did you think about that?
Well, I guess the first part of that question, the conditions that led to the growth in the business, there were a number of things going on in the ticketing industry specifically, and more generally in the internet space, that were really kind of trends or tailwinds for us in the secondary ticket market. The most notable examples are in the internet. You had obviously eBay, which in the mid to late 90s had really invented the whole concept of people transacting with one another, two people who didn't know each other could buy and sell a good on the internet without ever meeting one another. And that was a concept that helped StubHub as well, because our model is the same, where there's a buyer and seller who don't know each other who are buying and selling tickets. So that was one trend that kind of was a stepping stone for other consumer-to-consumer platforms like StubHub. Another trend that was going on was the kind of interstate commerce issues and the concept of the internet enabling transactions across state lines, and how that sort of impacted some of the gray areas around interstate commerce and around state regulatory issues. For example, in the secondary ticket market, there are no federal laws that regulate the secondary ticket market, but there are a handful of state laws that restrict how and when and where people can resell a ticket for how much money and things like that. And most states don't have that laws, but a handful of states had those laws. But the internet really put a big question mark on a lot of those regulatory questions, because how do you deal with a transaction where there's a buyer in New York selling New Jersey Devils ticket to who's buying from a seller who lives in Connecticut for an event that's in New Jersey from a website that's based in California, when there's four different states and four different state laws that could potentially have jurisdiction over that transaction. So that a lot of those questions, which were impacting taxation and things like that, were also a gray area that was a benefit for us, because we liked that gray area, because we were able to kind of deal with that gray area and build a big business when those questions weren't answered, when other people were scared to build a business because they were scared of a lot of those questions. So those are some of the things that helped us that were kind of going on in the market and helped our growth. As far as how we kind of generated a list of buyers and how we kind of got to the point in time where we were selling the company, you know, the company had scaled to a fairly sizable revenue base, where we were doing, you know, the year before we sold the company, roughly $400 million in ticket sales, $100 million in revenue, and, you know, positive cash flow and positive EBITDA with, you know, 300 employees or so. And we knew that the board sitting around the table and myself and other shareholders I spoke to, you know, knew that an exit was something that we could probably do in a 12 to 24 month time frame, whether it was going public or selling the business. And there had been some interest from various parties. So we had a very good relationship. I think Grant, you had mentioned about, you know, understanding the ecosystem of your competitive landscape and your business partners and building relationships with a lot of those other companies. We had already built a very good relationship with eBay in previous years because we had been working with them on some of these state regulations I told you about. We were lobbying to change the laws in a number of states, and eBay was our partner in those lobbying activities. So we had built that relationship with eBay. So we already had a good relationship with eBay and knew some of their people. And so when they became serious about buying a company, you know, it was just really them approaching us. We weren't trying to sell it per se. We weren't actively out there, you know, with a pitch book trying to sell the company, and we weren't about to go public either. But that really brought, as I said before, everything to a head, and we ultimately decided to sell the company to eBay.
That's great. Yeah, it's a terrific story. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. Another factor that I think I'd like to ask everybody to comment on is the team dynamics. When you have a management team and a board, they can be complicated, and obviously the board is going to be involved in any decision. The management team can choose to either keep the knowledge of what you're about tight, or can expand it and try and get the whole company more or less in line. I'd just like to go down the line here and ask each of these guys to comment on their view of a best practice, if there is one, in terms of how tightly do you control the knowledge of the process? Because it's really a very there are consequences in both directions. So I'd like to hear what people have to say.
You want to go first, Bill?
You can go.
I'll go first. First off, it's one of the hardest secrets in the world to keep. When there's a decision to sell, it's amazing how fast the information gets out to the employees. And one best practice you have to have from the outset is a communication plan. You have to figure out, first off, who's the inner circle, who is going to be on a need-to-know basis when you're going through the strategic evaluation process. What are those options you're going to think about pursuing and trying to work yourself through those? Once that's been set up, you've got to realize, okay, I've then got to go to a broader group that's probably going to help me get through the process. Buyer's going to want to interview certain people on management. I'm going to have to pull together a data room. I'm going to have information from strategic people. The circle gets wider and wider and wider. And we see a lot of problems from a management communication process to the employees when people don't anticipate what data they're going to need, what information they're going to need, who they're going to need in that circle, and how to set up the communication going forward. Because ultimately, you want to be prepared when the information gets out, and you want to be able to have your best foot forward. You want to have the story straight, and you want to make sure that you keep those key employees. So another thing that we have side by side with that communication plan is oftentimes retention programs and other types of incentive programs, whether it be educational with key managers to explain to them that they might be owning a piece of the transaction going forward with a new buyer. those types of things that are going to keep management involved, not only in the process of supporting you in a sell side or a divestiture, but also they've got to do their day jobs. They've got to be able to run the business. They've got to be not distracted, and they've got to minimize disruption. So having a plan to kind of juggle all those issues and communication is absolutely critical.
Are we, so this isn't just for the advisors?
No, this is for you guys too.
Okay. And I wasn't sure if you were focused on sort of the point in time that conversations start or maybe an LOI gets signed before a deal gets signed up or after a deal is a definitive agreement signed but before you tell the employees.
I think it depends on each company is a little bit different, but there's a distraction factor, and that distraction factor could enter early, it could enter late. If you need to have all the key employees interviewed, eventually they're going to have to know about this. But there's also a notion that people's, particularly if it's going to be a good outcome, people's ideas about wealth and wealth creation and next steps in their lives is enormous number of different kinds of thoughts that can enter into people's minds. So I'm just interested in each person's perspective on that because I don't think there is a rule other than keep it as tight as you can for as long as you can because that way people are going to focus on the business. But I still want to hear everybody's perspective.
Yeah, so I agree with the general rule, which is to try to minimize the number of people. It's sort of a need-to-know basis. In the period of time when conversations really start in earnest with a potential buyer, or if you're the buyer with a potential with the seller, I think you want to keep the number of people who are working on the team on your side on the transaction as small as possible. And every time somebody gets brought over the fence, you need to sit them down and tell them that they can't tell anybody else about it or they're going to get fired.
Including their wives or husbands.
Including their what?
Including their wives and husbands.
Right, that's right. In our transaction, we had the process worked in a way where we had some conversations, we agreed to engage with them, we negotiated price, we agreed to price, and at that point in time signed a letter of intent or an LOI, which was a very loosey-goosey, non-binding letter that meant that they could really do whatever they wanted, and so could we. But from that point on, there was about a three-month phase during which the buyer did a lot of due diligence, looked at a lot of information, both written information and also met with various employees. And then we also were negotiating the final contract during that three-month phase. And then at the end of that three-month phase, we basically signed the contract and on that day announced the deal in a press release. At the same time we announced the deal in a press release, we had all of our employees all of our San Francisco-based employees in one room, and then other employees from other offices called in for a company-wide conference call. So they found out right as the press release hit the wires. So the number of people who knew before that press release was probably maybe 15, but half of those people found out not that long before that point in time. And then the people who knew kind of real early on at day one when we first signed the letter was three or four people in the management team and the board.
So I think as a general rule, better to keep it tight and close. You can move faster. I think it's also got a little bit to do with the size of the company. If you're a really small company, you may need to involve a lot more people because people wearing multiple hats, and you are going to need to call on them to assist in pulling together data that the acquirer is looking at. But I think in general, you got to have a communication strategy, particularly if the company's got some, decent population, 100 people or more type of thing. And, I think you'll find you're going to go through different stages, as Jeff pointed out, from a conversation with a CEO to a CEO, and then it may evolve to some loose letter of intent, and all of a sudden they start digging into diligence, wanting information. Maybe a definitive agreement start showing up in some context, and you're going to eventually have to broaden that group, and inevitably, the word gets out. So I think you need to be prepared for that so that you can communicate clearly to the people And, you know, I'm a big believer in just managing expectations through the whole process with not only your management team but your employees as best you can. And I think you've got to judge it on a case-by-case basis. I'm involved with one company now where it's only been around, it's been around for 3 years. It's going to get acquired, and the entire employee base knows, which is an interesting dynamic. But that may work because it's more of a technology play than it is a big revenue play. So I think you've got to make that judgment on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, just two quick observations. Deals take a lot longer today than they did before, so these things can take 6, 8, 10, 12 months or more. So you got to be careful with how big the group is. That's number one. Number two is the best thing you can probably do to protect your employees is get the other side to sign NDAs and keep it limited into who sees the information on the potential buyers. Worst thing for your organization is when their sales guy, your sales guy hears from their sales guy that their company's for sale, so it mustn't be viable. That causes a lot more problem than the dysfunctionality of finding out whether or not we're going to be sold. So keep it tight on the other side.
Yeah, just add one other thing. I had one experience where the salespeople did talk to each other, and it leaked out to the customer base, and which is quite possibly one of the worst factors because the customer base, you know, starts freezing up, starts stopping POs, and that's not a good position to be in.
And just a small point, NDA is a non-disclosure agreement, and they're really important, particularly when you have a large public buyer that is asking you to sign an NDA, and they're very, very tightly worded. They're very typically constraining, and the more people you have within the company who are all bound by the NDA, who have loose lips, the more problems you might run into with your public acquirer. So it's really an important issue. Before this discussion started, I was talking with a few of these guys, and we were talking about the issue of how over this 3, 6, 10, 12-month period, what are the things you can or can't do to optimize or improve the chances, A, that the deal will close, and B, that it will close at a value that is attractive to you. And, you know, call it value enhancement or value preservation, but I think that everybody here has some ideas about that. And I'll start with Bill just because I think he was the one who raised the point in the first place.
No, my number one point is performance. If you drop the ball on your company while you're trying to sell it, that's going to be the biggest way that you either lose value you thought you had in the deal or have a company that's worth a lot less when you stop the process than when you started it. So it's basically managing performance, which is a little ad for the advisors. The advisors actually do add something. You want your CEO to be running the business day in and day out. The best way to enhance value is to beat expectations, not miss them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the biggest risk is always value preservation. Sellers are always trying to buy it cheap and sellers are always trying to sell it at the maximum price, and buyers are trying to get it as cheap as they possibly can. So preservation and management of expectations, don't overinflate your numbers because it'll come back to bite you ultimately in the process. The minute you fail a quarter, they just ratchet down the price on you, and it's pretty tough, if not impossible, to get out of that hole.
I would say another important thing to do in that time period is to keep your options open and not assume your transaction is going to close. You know, lots of times you'll have conversations with a buyer. It'll seem like things are going in the right direction, and you know, it just doesn't happen. So you never want to rely on that happening. You want to make sure your options are kept open. You know, you have enough cash in the bank and things like that, so that if either things fall apart, you're not left kind of at the altar with nothing else to do, or if you get into a situation where you miss a quarter and they try to use that as a negotiation leverage in terms of lowering price or putting other terms in that are not favorable to you or not agreeable to you, you have other options, or at least you can negotiate in a way that you have other options and not accept those unfavorable terms.
Yeah, operate the business like you're not going to sell it. There's no doubt about that. Run your process at the same time. They all make great points. Just a couple of other things to add. First off, make sure that you've anchored your key managers. That's absolutely critical. You don't want to have defections during the process. You don't want to lose what the buyer might be perceiving as the critical assets involved. Number two, make sure that the expectations that were set, well, the facts and the data and the information that set the expectations of the buyer actually do show up to be correct. A lot of people will think that, hey, if I just give them a copy of my audit, that's enough. And sometimes the companies aren't even audited. You really got to think about, look at your business through the eyes of the buyer. Try to figure out what the quality of that earning base is going to be, the quality of the balance sheet. What are the key drivers that are going to drive that value? Make sure you do some due diligence on yourself, whether it's bringing in somebody to kick the tires prior to talking with the buyer or doing it yourself. But make sure you understand where the issues are. And we got a silly phrase in our business, but we say, you know, make lemonade out of lemons. Don't be afraid to tell the things that will be challenging for that buyer or that could be ugly, that could cause some angst in your transaction, because you don't want them to raise those issues late in the deal. You want to raise them at the point that you have the most leverage, and that's right at the beginning when you're considering your options or you have multiple buyers at the table.
Good. I think we have just probably about 5 minutes, so if you have questions, start thinking about your questions. We have a microphone over there on the side. I really have two more questions or comments. One is, we talked about this earlier, and I don't think we have time for a full rehashing of it, but one thing that often happens, at least in this community, the Bay Area community, where there's a lot of venture capital, is if a company takes quite a long time to get to the point where it's created some value and it's raised capital from early stage venture capitalists or even angels and then has taken money later, you often have a syndrome or a situation where older investors are really ready for an exit the way some of Jeff's were, and yet newer investors are kind of fresh and hearty and hale and ready to go. And that can create misalignment in the boardroom and at the director level that has to be dealt with. So in that context, I'd like to ask just Bill and Fentress to comment briefly on how often that's a factor. How often do they see that? And then I'm going to go to last quick question.
All too often. We're often asked to play Solomon when there are those types of differences, whether it's someone's getting washed out or preferences or what have you. And a lot of what we're doing is managing all the different constituencies to try to get them to see the opportunity in the deal and not derail the project while it's going on. So it happens a lot because unless you're the only investor or you've got one class of investors, once there's a B round, they got different incentives, different timetables, and it just adds complexity exponentially to the process. Now, it's not an issue if the sales price is above the last round and everyone's happy, but a lot of the sales are sales of situations where everyone's not going to be happy and there's going to be some discomfort. So you just know that as you take money at different levels that if the outcome is below, you've got to deal with all that too, so you're selling your investors as well on the deal.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I think that's a great answer. I think that the real critical thing is to make sure that you've got all the strategic options up on the board, that everybody really understands what those options are. And oftentimes this is the time to bring in a professional, bring somebody in like Bill who can really give them a hard look at the marketplace, because oftentimes expectations around value, timing, and all your options are sometimes false expectations.
So great. So I was looking around, and I think there's just enough gray hair at this on this panel that I can ask the following question and use this analogy. So everybody here has had a few laps around the track at least, and I just would like to know from the advisors, what do red and yellow flags look like?
Red is they don't have enough cash to get through the quarter, much less the process it's going to take. That's our number one red flag. If a company wants to be sold and they can't fund themselves except for week to week, you're not going to get help from the advisor, and the buyer's going to take advantage of you.
Red is a seller thinking with his or her heart rather than objectively signing up with that first buyer that comes up with a valuation and heading off to the beach thinking your deal's done at the time of an LOI.
How about yellow?
Can you say that again?
Yeah.
Sure. Going back to Jeff's point, thinking that a deal is done at the LOI, it's not. You're not anywhere close. Oftentimes, it's not just the 3 months of due diligence. It can be 6, 9, 12, and the deal can evaporate.
Yellow for me is, and again, we spend at our firm a lot of time with technology companies, med tech companies. I can guarantee you that every software company wants to be sold to SAP or Oracle because they trade at 5 times revenues. And if people, I guess if people, you know, people come to you and they tell you what people want to buy, it's interesting. I wouldn't trust a banker who thinks he knows your business better than you do. But bankers do traffic in information, and you should get a banker who's having an active dialogue with the potential buyers in your industry. And if the banker is telling you something, or if you're a banker and you're hearing something from the clients which you know is directly opposed to what you're hearing from the potential buyer community, that's probably a pretty good yellow flag.
Anything to add?
Real quick, green is strong management, good technology, good business plan, cash in the bank, a good vision of what the objectives are, personal and for the shareholders, and a realistic expectation around who the buyers are and what they might be able to pay.
And I was actually going to toss that softball to Grant and Jeff. So what does a green flag look like? You guys both have experience with green flags as well.
I think it's what he said, basically.
That was the right answer, I know.
I was skipping to green.
That's okay. All right, good. So are there any questions from the audience at this point? There's a microphone right over there, if you wouldn't mind. And meanwhile, while we're waiting for people to get to the microphone, any lessons learned that we haven't talked about occur to you guys?
Every deal is different. There's not a textbook where you can get the right answer every time. So it's everyone's a different journey.
Okay.
And everything, Bill said it, in today's marketplace, everything takes a lot longer. It's with the credit markets the way they are, it doesn't just affect getting a bank loan. It has a trickle-down effect on all levels of capital.
Great. Question?
Yeah, this is targeted at Jeff, but I'd like to have the rest of you comment on it as well. You indicated that you were pretty much working with eBay with one buyer. And a couple of questions. Were there times in the process that you felt that there were maybe unnecessary delays and you got a little nervous? And how did you create an illusion of having a backup plan, having somebody waiting in the wings so that you did have an alternative if they took too long? Or how did you put starch in the system? And the other question that I have is, did you use an intermediary?
Yeah, let me answer the last one first because that's an easy one. Yes, we did. Allen & Company was our advisor. They're an M&A firm in New York focused on media and entertainment companies. The first question, I want to just correct something you said in your sort of in your question, which is that we only had one buyer. We were talking at the point in time when we did our transaction. We had been approached by eBay at various points in time over the 7 years that we were running the company. We had been approached by other buyers as well. So there were other people that we knew were interested at different points in time. And when eBay approached us at the most recent time, this ecosystem, I think Grant used that word as a good word, not only of other companies in the space, but also other companies in sort of peripheral industries like the live event industries and the ticketing industry like Ticketmaster and eBay, which is obviously a marketplace internet company, and e-commerce companies like Amazon. And there were a lot of different companies that you could see being potentially interested in acquiring StubHub. And we had some relationships with some of those companies at different points in time and at different levels. And so there were some conversations with other companies and there was some interest from other companies. But eBay was the most serious buyer, and we always felt was the most logical buyer because if you think about the business from a strategic perspective, made a lot of sense for eBay to acquire our company. And we didn't think there was any other company that had that level of strategic fit with what StubHub was doing. And because of that, a conclusion that could be drawn, although not necessarily correct, may be that they also may be willing to pay the most because they had the best strategic fit. So the alternative that we looked most closely at was going public, and that was because we felt we could go public. At the time when we sold the business to eBay, the public markets were very much available for companies like StubHub. And so that was really the alternative. Once we decided to engage with eBay, that was the alternative we spoke most about. It was also the alternative where you tend to get a little valuation pop with all these other negatives. One of the actual positives about the public markets versus a private sale is in most of the time you get a little higher valuation. So that was another benefit of using that as a stalking horse, if you will. That's probably the wrong word, but as an alternative, because we could talk about a higher valuation. So I think that answers your question. And you know that's kind of the situation we were in.
So I think there are a bunch of other questions. I think we'd like to. You can talk to Jeff after the meeting. I want just very quickly as a reminder to our audience. This is the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're discussing exit strategies, making the decision to sell. I'm Kip Scheline, Managing Director of Levinson Venture Partners, and I'm here with Fentress Seagroves, partner with PricewaterhouseCoopers Private Company Services Group, Jeff Fleur, the founder and former CEO of StubHub, Grant Evans, former CEO of A4 Visions, and Bill Wazielowski, partner with Seven Hills Partners.
It just goes back to valuations. Once you've made the decision to sell, how do you come up with a valuation? Grant mentioned at one point that they had a 14 times revenue, which sounds like a really nice late 1999 type of value. Mm-hmm. Once you've made that decision, what kind of things do you look at, and how do you come up with a range that you're willing to go at?
What the banker's going to do is look at comparable transactions, how the market trades, the acquisition history, and again, there's lots of science, but there's lots of art. And the truth of it is that a buyer wants to do a transaction that is accretive to its own value, and they can rationalize that a whole host of ways. It could be paying a lower multiple relative to the company's earnings net of synergies. So at the end of the day, it's going to be kind of a dark cloud as to how people rationalize the valuation. Some companies, actually, IBM's a good example. If you go look at all of IBM's deals that they've done and you look at the multiple of invested capital by venture capitalists in the company, you will see a very tight range of 3 to 5 times. Now, there's some outliers on either end of it, but a quality company that IBM wants to own, they will basically say, how do I have to separate this from its current investors? And as Kip will tell you, 3 to 5 times earnings and 3 to 5 times in 3 to 5 years means that he's going to be able to raise another fund. So there's lots of different ways to look at it. In a perfect world, so a banker's dream world, the green flag is that you have a business that is functioning at or near the top performers in a sector. There's clear evidence of where these companies trade in the marketplace. It's pretty tight in terms of the multiple range, and you can do a valuation off of that. Usually companies all have their different warts and opportunities, and so there's a lot of art.
Great. Thank you.
Several of you mentioned it's important to have enough cash on the balance sheet, and I assume they have a well-established company if you want to sell it. But what if you're not quite at that stage and you want to raise more money to build the company up so you can get more money when you sell it? What's the best way to raise the additional money to further along your company?
See him.
Well, I mean, I will start. Depending upon what the position of the company is, where they are competitively, how mature the product is, it may very well be that venture capital is a place for you to go. If it's too small for an institutional investor, maybe that there are angels who are very early stage investors who are interested. And if it's a later stage company that is not yet profitable but has the kind of profile that Bill was talking about earlier, maybe the right thing to do is to go to a private equity buyer and perhaps even sell some secondary shares, get fresh capital into the company, and really start the clock again. So there's a range of options. You guys can comment on them as well.
Yeah, I think it depends on where the company is, and I think there's clearly a set of venture capitalists or angel investors. Everybody has an appetite for something at some valuation, but I think it really comes down to where you are with the company in terms of its growth, how much money you're looking to pull into the company. And one thing I would say to you is you should go out and do some research, because I've seen so many entrepreneurs, trooping up and down Sand Hill Road, groveling for money, and they never get anywhere, versus going through a targeted list of understanding, matching up with that VC, matching up with the size of the fund, and you'll find much greater success in a much shorter time as opposed to just traipsing around Silicon Valley, and all the Sand Hill guys.
Next question.
Good evening. I was curious how you've calibrated your clients' expectations towards the diligence process, which can be quite grueling as it goes on. And I was also curious how you felt how the virtual data rooms have impacted the diligence process.
On a virtual data room, that's helped immensely. Now, there's some upfront work. We work with a handful of the providers, but it's a tactic as well. So your diligence is always going to take a long time, but if you can get your books and records electronically into a data room, they have organizing tools that are fantastic. But more importantly, from the banker's perspective, we can see who is looking at the data room, how many minutes, what documents they're looking at, where they're spending their time, and that helps us from a tactical point of view. So it's going to be a big slog. So you need a strong CFO. You need someone like Ventris and his group in advance helping you put together the data room. There are firms out there who
Okay. Can you repeat that? Bill, just repeat
No, I heard it. So how do you convince the clients that they need help? I mean, you only have one shot to sell your company. Well, if you screw up, you have multiple shots. But we spend a lot of time, and we talked about this in the back room, the things that we will do for our clients is we help them understand that they need an experienced lawyer. The lawyer who put together their formation papers and works out of a small office in Walnut Creek may be very good at that, but they're going to have their lunch eaten if a big firm comes in and says, you know, here's a contract that's standard, believe me. They're either going to spend a lot of your money or they're going to give you bad advice. Same thing on the finance side. You got to have a good finance team. You got to have a good auditor. It doesn't have to be Big Four, but it's got to be someone who's going to pass muster. And on this data room, you know, we spend a lot of time convincing our clients that it's helpful, it's worth the cost. We negotiate on their behalf, but it really makes life a lot easier, and certainly easier than when we started doing this stuff 20, 25 years ago, where it was boxes and you sat in rooms and you watched people. So,
I'll just make one quick comment. I think that companies make a mistake when they're doing online data room by just merely downloading everything and thinking that they've answered the buyer's issues. There's so much work that can go into making it really quality and useful for a buyer, including bridges from year to year, trying to figure out what key operational metrics are, breaking down vendors, breaking down customers, looking at trends, looking potentially at profit margins by product, by sectors. I mean, there's so much that you can really do to assist a buyer, and information is key. Information adds value. Information drives value. And the better the quality of the information, the more likely it is that value is going to be the highest, and it's going to stay high as you move from LOI to close.
That's great. We have time for one more question.
Thank you. This question is probably directed more towards the entrepreneurs, but during the evaluation process, what are the main strategic points or pressure points you can sort of apply during the negotiations process?
Was that for me?
Either you or Grant.
Good question. Tough question. So my approach in the deals that I've done is really coming back to I'll certainly go and canvas the market and do some benchmarks out there, and the public companies are the obvious ones and low hanging fruit to get information on, and I think that where the industry is and its growth or its morphing is going to be a factor on valuations going out at whatever time you're selling the company. But I think the pushing buttons are the alignment pieces with that company that's acquiring you, how valuable they will see you. And I think someone said, put yourself in the eyes of the buyer, right? How valuable is this? To their overall vision as a company. So understanding those buyers' vision, mission, where they're going is really important. And if you can fit yourself into that puzzle as being incredibly important or bigger than life, then your valuation, that's a button for them. And certainly having options where you can have stalking, competitors in the background is going to make them want it even more. So I think that those two are sort of two pieces, understanding your buyer, where you fit in their puzzle, and then two, certainly maybe it's casually letting them know there's other people after you as well. There's nothing more than, people want something more if they can't get it. So they have a tendency to sort of grope and prices go up perhaps.
But be very judicious when you threaten that there's someone else out there. I have plenty of clients who will say, we got three LOIs. and you don't have anything. And you got to bring things to a processor's conclusion that has to be brought. So you got to be very judicious about playing the game of trying to get value. At the end of the day, sometimes the entrepreneurs get together and they agree what it's going to take. Sometimes it's the bankers. Sometimes it's just pure math. Sometimes it's just we will pay a price that is dilutive now but has to earn out, which means not have any negative impact on earnings in 3 years. It's going to depend on the situation. And again, I think one of the things I mentioned on a call this morning is that the best of all worlds is that someone wants to buy you. And if someone wants to buy you, you're going to get the best valuation. And if you want to be sold, it's a crapshoot as to whether or not you're going to get the best price or not. But a buyer who desperately wants to own you will pay an irrational price. And so the best of all worlds is that someone comes knocking on their door and decided they're in love with you and want to own you.
There's a there are some aphorisms that apply here. And again, not to reduce everything we've said today to the simplest of terms, but generally speaking, for instance, on the trading desk, if you ask a trader why did the stock go up, he'll tell you there's more buyers than sellers. Okay, and you know it's really that simple. The more scarcity value there is for your company, the more likely you are to have an outcome that will approach your expectations. I think this panel's done a great job tonight, and I want to thank them very, very much. And please join me in applause.